Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Suicide rates for Ohio youth have dramatically increased over the past decade. A recent report from the Ohio Department of Health found that between 2007 and 2018, suicide was the leading cause of death for children ages 10 to 14. Every day in Ohio, a young person dies by taking his or her own life every 33 hours. Experts say that there's no single reason, but childhood has changed. The stressors are different. We talk about how children are responding to the changes and how adults are responding to the children today. Dr. Mark Hurst is the medical director at the Ohio Department of Health. I thought we'd start with you first. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ann. I wish we were talking about a happier topic.
Yeah, you know, it's something that's come up repeatedly. And even though I talk about this issue of childhood stress, and suicide and have in the past, I was still shocked by those numbers. Were you?
Well, this is something that we monitor on a regular basis. So, you know, we were aware that this was increasing. I was not shocked, but certainly I think all of us are disheartened by it. And when you look at the statistics over the past 9 years, especially past 10 years, it really highlights the dramatic increase in suicide rates across the country, not just in Ohio, and particularly among our youngest people who are really just getting started in life, and for them not to live the kind of life that they could, making themselves and their families proud, is really disheartening.
The executive director of the Ohio Suicide Prevention Foundation told the Dispatch in an article that this is a public health problem that needs to be addressed ASAP. How do you do that? I mean, what are the when we talk about public health problems, we're usually thinking about things like, you know, the flu or the measles, stuff like that. This is different.
Well, we really need to have a broader view of what public health problems are. So anything that affects the longevity of people or causes difficulty in their functioning, we really need to think of as a public health problem. Certainly the opioid crisis that we've been facing over the past 10 or 15 years is very much a public health crisis. And the increase in suicide rates is also a public health problem and one we need to approach from a public health perspective.
And how do you do that?
Well, it requires a multifactorial and multifaceted approach. So obviously, the best way to deal with any particular problem is prevention. If people don't develop the problem in the first place, whether that problem is an infectious disease or whether that problem is suicidal ideation, that's the best possible thing that we can do. We also need to have early intervention, where we start to identify warning signs before someone may actually be ill with any particular problem, and have the ability then to intervene before it really evolves to the point that it might. Then we need to have effective and evidence-based practices. And certainly we have that for the treatment of depression and the treatment of suicidal ideation. And then we need to have life-saving measures that are available that if someone is having suicidal thoughts or may have had a suicide attempt, that we can help them with that so they can live to have another day and recover from the problems that they're experiencing.
Do we have any sense? I know that there's a lot of factors involved in this, but from a public health point of view, what do you see as prevention in this?
Well, there are a lot of things that we can do with prevention, and it is not only a public health problem, but it's a very complicated public health problem. There are so many different ways that things interact to lead any particular individual to consider or to attempt suicide, and for the rates to go up or down in any particular community. So if we look at it on a broad population basis, there are things that we can do in school kind of settings. There's something called the PACS Good Behavior Game, which is utilized in many elementary schools. And that is shown to improve life outcomes in many ways. Kids who have participated in that are less likely to develop mental illness. They're more likely to graduate from high school. They're less likely to be incarcerated, and they're less likely to have suicidal thoughts and suicide attempts. So that's just kind of one example of that. Things called Nurse Family Partnership, which is a home visiting program for mothers and their families early in a child's life, and even in the first year or so. And that helps with parenting skills, which gets kids off on the right approach in life and makes it less likely for them to have problems down the road. We really need to focus very, very seriously on the prevention of abuse and neglect. There's something called adverse childhood experiences. And the more adverse childhood experiences that someone has, the less likely it is that life is going to turn out well for them. And these adverse childhood experiences include things like physical, emotional, or sexual abuse, physical or emotional neglect, and then other kinds of things, such as having a parent incarcerated, losing a parent to death, having a parent with mental illness, or having a parent with addiction, or having a parent incarcerated. The more of those a person has, the less likely they are to graduate from high school, the more likely they are to have depression, the more likely they are to use substances, and the more likely they are to have suicide attempts. So focusing on the prevention of those things and then dealing with them as they're identified is something that can have a good preventive effect down the road also.
You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking with Dr. Mark Hurst. He's the medical director at the Ohio Department of Health about the recent report from the department that found that between 2007 and 2018, suicide was a leading cause of death for children ages 10 to 14 and the second leading cause of death for children ages 15 to 24. If you have a question or comment this hour, give us a call, 614-292-8511. Or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Over the weekend, Dr. Hurst, I was reading parts of the Chicago Tribune series on isolation rooms for children in schools and the problem with that. I heard Jennifer Smith Richards of the Chicago Tribune, a former dispatch reporter, by the way, talking with NPR this morning about that series and about the problems. And it tends to be children who already have emotional issues, emotional disabilities tend to be affected by that. And then on the other end of the spectrum, on the front page of the Dispatch, there's a story about how colleges and universities are seeing a huge uptick in the demand for mental health services that they can't even begin to respond to their student body needs when it comes to mental health care. Do you see opportunities, you know, on either side of that spectrum at this point?
Well, I think we have to see opportunities, and certainly they exist. We are definitely seeing increased rates of mental illness in young people. Now, in part, that may be a good thing. There may be less stigma that's associated with seeking treatment, mm-hmm. and so people are more likely to recognize symptoms that they're having and then to seek treatment. On the other hand, we don't totally understand why the rates are genuinely increasing. It's not really just an increased rate of treatment seeking, it is a genuine increase in rates of mental illness. And, you know, people have speculated about a lot of different things with that. Is it isolation associated with social media and the internet and smartphones and things like that? Those are actually a double-edged sword. Does the opioid epidemic have something to do with this? With more children who are basically parentless because a parent is using drugs or a parent has been incarcerated or even in a worst case scenario, a parent has died. I think that there are lots of potential contributors to this, all of which we need to consider and consider reacting to.
Do we have one of the problems is, as I said, that the colleges and universities are overwhelmed by this. You can ask almost anybody who has a child that is seeking psychiatric or psychological counseling, and it's really hard to find specialists that work with adolescents and young children on that score. There's just not enough out there. Can money buy this, or do we have to strategically change what our goals are when it comes to educating people and training people to treat mental health issues in children?
Well, certainly we have shortages of workforce in the mental health field at this point. And that's something that is an active goal of Governor DeWine's Recovery Ohio initiative, as well as a number of other things. So we really need to look at this in a broad way. First, we need to consider that each of us has a role to play with this, that by us showing concern for children, our friends, our relatives, and things like that, that has an impact. we started by talking about suicidal thoughts. Yeah. And when a person is feeling suicidal, they're feeling alone, they're feeling isolated, they're feeling hopeless. And having another human being care about them can really make a difference with that. To carry that another step, there are trainings available called mental health first aid, which are similar to physical first aid, that teach people, ordinary citizens, how to react to someone who may be having some mental health disorders. Of course, that in and of itself isn't enough. Professional treatment is necessary also. So we have been working with primary care doctors to enhance their skills in terms of the identification and treatment of depression, of substance use disorders, and other mental health problems. And we continue to work to try to expand our workforce in terms of both counselors, psychiatrists, psychologists, and others who have a contribution to make here.
Besides the whole digital impact from everything from smartphones to computers and social media and all the isolation, ironically, that takes place there, it's for a long time, it predates all of that, is kids don't have the free time they used to have. I mean, I look back on it and sometimes think, well, there weren't girls, you know, teams when I was a kid, because they're just, unless you were, you know, an Amazon and tall and could play those kinds of sports, we didn't have that. I kind of look back and think, well, wow. But on the other hand, now the kids are constantly being directed to one activity or another. They're being put in aftercare programs. They're being in sports. They're going to arts camps. You know, they're doing all kinds of things that require structured play, not free play. Is that an emotional need for our children that we're ignoring at this point?
I think it's really hard to say, Anne. I mean, one thing that we know is that engagement in extracurricular activities has good preventive effects itself. So we want kids to be involved in extracurricular activities. But I think the question that you raised in terms of, is there a point where a kid becomes too programmed and it becomes too high pressure and they don't have enough downtime is a very good one, to bring up. You know, another thing that's shown to be helpful in terms of general prevention is having meals with the family. And in fact, kids who have dinner with their family more nights of the week than not are less likely to have trouble in a variety of ways. They're more likely to do well in school. They're less likely to have mental illness, and a lot of good things happen with that. So I think there needs to be a balance between programmed activities and free time, and that's something that each family really needs to decide on their own.
Are you able to, from the Ohio Department of Health, drill down into these statistics and see any kind of patterns emerge over the last 10 years among those 10 to 14-year-olds, for instance?
So, you know, we certainly do epidemiological evaluations, and it's done elsewhere in the state as well. We actually have some of the best suicide research in the country that's done right here at Nationwide Children's Hospital under the work of Dr. Jeff Bridge. So these are things that are being looked at on a regular basis. If I could go back and talk about the internet and the role of technology with
sure.
this, I'd appreciate it. I don't think we can look at this as all good or all bad. I mean, certainly there are some negative aspects of it. Cyberbullying, and, you know, we know anecdotally there have certainly been cases of cyberbullying, of kids experiencing cyberbullying and having suicide attempts or even completed suicide. It's also easy to investigate means of suicide, and it can promote isolation. And in some ways, suicide attempts can be glamorized, which tends to lead to more clusters or more copycat kind of events. But the other side of that is that for people who would otherwise be isolated, it can promote social connectedness. There's some good research going on in looking at word patterns in social media postings that may be predictive of someone having a suicide attempt and could be intervened on. There are apps to augment traditional treatment for depression. And then there's also the ability to seek help directly, such as through the crisis text line, which is available throughout the country and right here in Ohio.
So that's the upside of it. But we'll post a link to the text line, to the text number, but most people don't know about that.
Yeah, and that's something that we really want to promote. And, you know, we're glad that you're shedding light on the issue today and willing to post that. So, you know, there is help available immediately, either through the Suicide Prevention Lifeline, mm-hmm. calling that, which is 1-800-273-TALK or 1-800-273-8255, or using the crisis text line and texting for HOPE. That's the number 4, H-O-P-E, to the number 741-741.
Well, Dr. Hurst, I appreciate your time today kicking off the conversation. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
It's Dr. Mark Hurst. He's the medical director at the Ohio Department of Health, which recently reported that the number leading cause of death for children ages 10 to 14 is suicide. They had a report that looked at the years between 2007 and 2018. We will continue our conversation. We welcome your thoughts, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
StoryCorps shares unscripted conversations between two people about important things in life: love, loss, family, friendship. StoryCorps partnered with WOSU Public Media to record and share the stories of our city. Recorded here, StoryCorps Columbus preserves pieces of our shared history for future generations. Subscribe to the StoryCorps Columbus podcast now at wosu.org/StoryCorps, on the WOSU mobile app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. This is sort of a Save Our Children episode today. Suicide rates for Ohio youth have dramatically increased over the past decade. A recent report from the Ohio Department of Health found that between 2008 and 2018, suicide was the leading cause of death for children's ages 10 to 14. Every day in Ohio, a young person dies by taking his or her own life. Every 33 hours. Mimi Brodsky-Chenfeld teaches teachers, parents, and children of all ages throughout the United States and beyond the art of play. Her two collections, Teaching in the Key of Life and Teaching by Heart, plus articles, stories, and poems, are enjoyed worldwide. And since 1970, she has taught in numerous schools and programs in Columbus. She is a regular, pretty much regular guest on All Sides with Ann Fisher. And she has been warning about this problem for years. Welcome back, ma'am.
Thank you, Ann.
Mary Freistad is a professor of psychiatry at Ohio State University, where she studies child psychology. Thanks for joining us. I appreciate it.
Absolutely.
Mary Freistad, I mean, what do you think about when you hear these statistics?
Well, as Dr. Hurst said, we've been aware of this for some time, and the past 10 years has really, the numbers have increased dramatically. The rates of anxiety, depression, and suicide-related behaviors, thinking about suicide, making a plan, making an attempt, and tragically, dying from suicide.
Does it manifest differently, do we know, in children than it does in adults?
When kids are feeling hopeless, they're feeling disconnected from others, and they don't see a way out, they will see dying as the only way. And they need to see other kinds of options. They need to be connected with others.
Do you have a sense about how well they understand the finality of suicide?
Younger kids, if they've not experienced a death in a family, you know, if we're talking kind of under the age of 10, but by the time you're 10, you've experienced some kind of death. Somebody in your world has likely died. Maybe it's a pet, maybe it's a great-grandparent. but I think from 10 onward, there's a reasonable sense of the finality of death. But it's not being able to understand the impact of all of that loss, all of the things that you won't be in your own life, and the loss for everybody around you. This is probably the most painful experience that a parent can possibly have. Losing a child to death of any type is tragic, but when a child dies from suicide, it leaves parents with so much guilt, shame. It's a lifetime legacy, and we need kids to feel more connected and to understand that people care about them, so that they can see the purpose of living.
You know, Mimi Chenfeld, I mentioned that you've been kind of talking about what could happen when we start to take away all the free
joyful
play and the joyfulness of play and the silliness and all the good things about it. You've talked about this for years, and that's why we invited you on.
You know, I have a T-shirt that says, "I can't believe I'm still protesting all this." It has another word, but I'll substitute stuff. The same things that we've been, as you said, Mary, the same things that we've been concerned about for years. I was just thinking more, not so much the statistics, which are devastating, and the reality of what's happening, which is devastating, but the whole idea of how we get kids through trauma, because this is traumatic. Whatever's causing, you know, the series of issues or incidents or experiences that the older children are having that's leading them to such a devastating decision is under the heading of trauma. However they see what's happened to them is something that they can't live through anymore and or bear. And I was just thinking how easy it is to it's not easy, but how non-clinical or just a way of connecting the children from earliest times to things that they love, to things that are joyful, to things that are safe, so that the whole world is, everything now is instant. I was thinking, because I'm old, I was thinking in the old days, something dreadful happened in the world, and it maybe took a while before people realized it. Now we live through the dreadful as it's happening, and our children are living through it. And they're looking at the world, and they may be saying, this is a terrible place to be, you know, with the violence and the headlines and the bullying and the current events, you know, fears and traumas, and their own personal ones that they've had forever. You know, children with parents who don't love or may not love them, or friends who are mean to them. I mean, the little traumas that we think of childhood. Mm-hmm. So it's a very traumatic time for children of all ages now.
And at a time when you have relatively less control over your environment.
Exactly.
And don't know how to manage that.
How do we provide safe places, safe people, safe experiences that are just part of the child's life, that it isn't all, you know, awfulness. It isn't all negativity. I have a place that I go that's a safe and wonderful place. That's why, you know, I've been talking for 100 years about creative education, mm-hmm. loving education, school and programs after school and community centers have to be welcoming and loving and fun. And children need to be engaged in things that are part of their lives. If a child has nothing, hasn't got music or hasn't got art or hasn't got baseball or hasn't got a friendship group, I mean, that's really isolation. But when they have it, it's that connection you were talking about, Mary. And that's the society, you know, the community. It takes a neighborhood to raise a child, and that's where we all need to come in on this. I'll say more later because I want to take a blah, 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 blah.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News, and I know that we're just going to scratch the surface. It's just an hour, but we're talking about adult response to these horrible statistics that show the rate of suicide increasing dramatically over the past 10 years among children in Ohio and across the country. It was the leading cause of death for children ages 10 to 14 between 2007 and 2018. You just heard from Mimi Brodsky-Chemfeld. She teaches parents, teachers, and children of all ages about the art of play. Her two collections are Teaching in the Key of Life and Teaching by Heart. She has been teaching in Columbus and schools and programs around the city since 1970. Also with us, Mary Freistadt. She is a professor of psychiatry at Ohio State, where she studies child psychology. If you have a question or comment, want to join the conversation, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Mary, 10 seems so young, but that's just the statistics for 10 to 14 year olds. Children do take their own lives at younger ages.
Yes. It's younger than the age of 10 is not common.
Okay.
But it does happen. And I think Meme's comments about having joy, kids really need to feel valued and there needs to be meaning in life. And so Dr. Hurst had talked about family dinners, I think, which is a
It sounds
really,
prosaic, but
it's not. It's a no-cost intervention. Yeah. Think about what a family dinner means.
Unless you're working two jobs to put food on the table.
Right, right. For those who can, it brings the family together. It affords a time to communicate with each other, to be connected. If a family can get into the habit of even working on planning the meal together so that it's an activity that they're involved with together, it becomes really a very enriching kind of an experience and not isolating. One of the things that Dr. Hurst had talked about was the two-edged sword of social media. And this, and Meme, you talked about the rapidity of current life. Everything is so rapid. And we know that when kids are contemplating suicide, if the means are removed for a brief period of time, those feelings subside. They don't stay at that intense level of there's no other solution but to kill myself. Okay. So if we can help kids make more space and more patience in their lives, I think that's one of the things that we can do for kids. We know that the rates of meditation are increasing, which is a good substitute because we also know that the rates of faith attendance and participation are going down in this country. So where are the lessons that kids have to kind of sit quietly with their feelings, to know that they can get past, that there is hope? Where are those messages of hope coming from?
And that's interesting
because
really I remember during church it was Latin Mass when I was a kid, and I never could understand a word they were saying, but it was a time just to repose quietly.
And we have very little time now that we aren't barraged by input.
Right.
And so we need to create some space where kids can creatively play, where they can have some nothing, some downtime,
some de-stressing.
Thought.
I want to take a quick call. Kathy in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Kathy.
Hi. Yeah, I think you might have just touched on the question I was going to ask. It was related to how, if there's any consideration given to how religious and spiritual values can affect this epidemic.
Well, I wondered why do you ask that? What made you ponder that?
Well, it seems like there's a decrease in the emphasis on in society. It seems like those types of values, and without being specific, have declined in society to me. So, you know, I was just wondering if they were considering that at all in their treatment, or how it could possibly affect, you know, this epidemic.
Well, I think it really speaks to value and meaning. And when people are feeling rotten about themselves, it's really good to pull out of your own self and do for others. So when I'm working with kids who are clinically depressed, one of my recommendations, one place where I will explore is there a way that you can volunteer? Can you help some other kids? If you're in the fifth grade, is there a class of first graders who could use some help? Is there a place where you could go and help with animals? Is there a place that you could help somebody or something else. And it pulls people out of their own misery and gives them some perspective on life.
You know, Mr. Rogers said in a time of crisis or something, when something's going horribly wrong, look for the helpers.
Yes.
I mean, that's also a direction to send somebody to be around other people who are doing something healthy and helping others and being around other kinds of positive people.
Totally. And you see every not frequently enough, but you see wonderful stories about young people starting beautiful gifting services and actually enlisting many other children to join them. And we don't ask them enough to do this. We don't ask them.
The
older kids
are waiting.
You know, and I'll just say one quick thing, but I wanted to just throw something else in. That was a very good question, Kathy, about spiritual, because I think a lot of the religions, I grew up in the Bronx and in a Catholic neighborhood, and when I went with my friends, it was a very scary place. When we went to the church, I sucked my thumb like, this is a scary place. But now the Catholic churches I've been to are much more communicating with the kids. They're more relevant. They use guitars. They sing. I mean, they're trying to reach them in a way that's a lot different than growing up in a more strict, you know, just learn this by rote kind of a religious experience for children. But I wanted to bring in, if I can, just quickly the arts along with play, because music, and this is where we all come in to be advocates, that they don't reduce this in the schools, that they keep, so many times they say, okay, we'll do after school, but you now need to pay.
Yeah.
Or we take the art teacher is walking around with a cart and doesn't even have a room. Or the music teacher is pregnant and we don't have music, and the kindergarten is now first grade and they've taken the play and the joy out of so many schools. This is adults making decisions for kids that are so dangerous, to have the children not have music in their lives, have songs and stories and playful times. Just a quick, I know because we have time, talking fast. So 9/11 was a disastrous time in this country, but years before, some of you may remember, there was another attack on the Trade Towers.
Right.
And I know about that because of family and stuff in New York City, but some folks may not have read this. The elevators are gigantic, and this is before the 9/11. This is the first attack, and the whole building. Any one of us listening now, if we were in an elevator that had three floors and the elevator was stuck on the second floor, we would be like, dear God, we're done. Terrifying experience. So here are the elevators going up to 100-something floors, and here are these kindergarten children in a gigantic elevator with their teachers and volunteers, you know, for the room mothers, et cetera. So maybe two kindergarten classes, so that's like 30 children or maybe more, stuck in an elevator in the towers. Smoke is coming up. The motor stopped. They're in between floors for hours. We are talking trauma.
What'd they do?
Okay, here's the story. Downstairs, they called in psychiatrists and they called in child care workers to wait if they ever got them down. Miraculously, don't ask how, after some hours, the elevator came down. Everyone was waiting for the children. This had to be one of the most trauma. The kids came up, dum da dum bum 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 ba bum. What? What? Hi, everybody. What? Did the teachers give them worksheets? Did they give them effing tests? Did they give them orders? They sang. They played. They told stories. Of course, when the teachers came out, they dropped dead. You know, the children came out. It was in the paper, miraculously, because it was part of their lives. They knew the songs. They knew the stories. It was things they loved that were familiar, that were comforting. And the teachers kept. So we don't do this enough to give these kids the tools. Some of the tools are joyful and fun and familiar and loving. Mm-hmm. And I think if the kids had that when they cut off and they don't feel anything, and there's no one there,
maybe they could color. Maybe they
this
could,
is a way yeah, to get drug, through. Get through. You know, it's engaging them.
I had not heard that story before.
Oh, yeah,
thanks for sharing that, ma'am. We're going to get right back to it. We have to take a quick break. I hope you'll stay with us. We are talking about childhood. You know, the struggles of childhood and what they have to do with these drastic increases in rates of suicide among our children. And those are the ones that succeed. There's probably many, many more out there who think about it, who try it, who don't succeed. All of them, that's what we're talking about today. My guest, you just heard from Mimi Brodsky-Chenfeld. She's an educator and author. She's been teaching since the 70s in the Columbus area. And also Mary Freistad. She's a professor of psychiatry at The Ohio State University's Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Health. She specializes in child psychology. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Suicide rates for Ohio youth have dramatically increased over the past decade. A recent report from the Ohio Department of Health found that between 2007 and 2018, suicide was the leading cause of death for children ages 10 to 14. We're talking about that today and how we can respond as adults. Still with us, Mimi Brodsky-Chenfeld teaches teachers and parents and children of all ages throughout the U.S. and beyond the art of play. Mary Freistad is a professor of psychiatry at Ohio State, where she studies child psychology. Welcome again to both of you. If anyone out there has a question or comment, wants to join the conversation, the number is 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Mary Freistad, you said that, you know, Dr. Hurst from the Ohio Department of Health, we talked to earlier in the program, made the salient point about just having dinner together and sharing dinner. But it's also about what you eat for dinner. And there's a lot of like healthy things that we could be doing. You know, exercise is great for stress reduction.
There's a lot of what I like to call free medicine available. And I would start with sleep. We know that probably most teenagers in particular do not get enough sleep. And probably all of us know how we feel when we're a little sleep deprived and it doesn't enhance our moods. So kids who are sleeping with their smartphone under their pillow and are getting woken up at night, or that they kind of can't unwind because they've had the blue light coming at them, which also interferes with sleep, as well as the content of what they've been doing online right before they go to bed, so that socially they're keyed up, it doesn't allow for enough sleep time. And then you've got kids who are very, very scheduled and very busy, either with part-time jobs or co-curricular activities, their schoolwork, their social life, not getting enough sleep, not eating healthfully. There are ways to do that that are not terribly expensive. So it's not, and you getting enough sleep, eating healthfully, don't have to be expensive things. Getting enough exercise, which again doesn't have to be an expensive kind of an activity. Walking or running really does that. Playing on a team is great if you've got that team camaraderie and the team cohesion, but not all kids really respond to that. They're just not competitive kind of kids, or they don't have any particular athletic skill. So team sports aren't always the way, but they can be the way. The other piece I would say about exercise is if kids can get out into nature in some way. We live in such a not in touch with the natural environment world now. We have artificial lights. We spend most of our time indoors. We're just not getting out into soothing nature. So if people can get out to parks, can get out into the countryside, it's really very good for mental health. And then that piece that we talked about earlier with either meditation or prayer, having a way of quieting oneself and centering oneself is really vital for mental equilibrium.
Beautiful. beautiful, Mary. I agree with absolutely everything. And actually, many teachers are doing yoga in the classroom and meditation,
right,
and playing. And having,
but we've done programs on it, yeah.
I was thinking, the kids need a safe places and something safe. School has to be safe, a program at church. I mean, they need a safe, if home isn't a safe place, they need a safe place, yeah. Something safe, a safe person. Then there's studies that kids who've gone through the trauma that you were talking about, I'm sorry, I think have a square head, the trauma that you've talked about. And the studies have shown that kids who've come through that and have had fulfilling lives, statistics are high that everyone says they had one person in their life, could have been a teacher,
yeah,
a clergyman, a director of something, just a person who cared about them.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, this is just people listening. You could be the person who doesn't even realize that you're that important to a child. And so being responsive to a child and noticing a child, plus a place and something that engages them. If they have music, if they have singing, if they have, look at Harmony, 500 people are in that chorus. It's joyful. It
a
takes them
project,
away.
Right.
I'm talking quickly because of time, but we went to the Marion Correctional Institute last week,
uh-huh,
which is a
prison.
You know, a yeah, prison. And we saw the prisoners' chorus present Hamilton.
Yes, I saw that too.
And was it unbelievable?
It's phenomenal.
And
yeah,
when they spoke after, they said, yeah, it, for the year that they've been practicing, I forgot I was in prison.
It's absolutely
phenomenal. It took
me
away.
Yeah.
So play and the arts and exercise and take us away from a scene that could be traumatic. They give you another place to be. But when they don't have that, then they're stuck in that place of trauma and loneliness and isolation. So we have a big job to do to provide those places.
Charlotte in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Charlotte.
Yeah, good morning. Thanks for taking the call. I'm wondering about the role of extended family members. I know we live in an era where a lot of families are just so fractured and moving from one shelter to the other. But I also remember that I used to get off my day shift job, drive 40 miles and babysit my nephews while my sister worked her evening job. And my evening, Carol, was, I hear the train a-coming, it's rolling around the bend, and you ain't washed your armpits since I don't know when. Now get into the bathtub before I tan your hide, because school starts tomorrow and you're going clean. And I got the critique back, you funny Aunt Charlotte.
That's great.
Mary Freistad, what about that? I mean, that could be that safe place, that extended family, right?
Right. Extended families are a beautiful thing. What we all need to create, and some of us have actual biologically related family members near us, and then some of us have to create family,
mm-hmm,
because we really don't have available, or if family members aren't supportive, finding other friends to become family. But having that social network, I think you raised a really good point, having a rich social network that you can be a support to others and they can be a support to you is really vital.
You know, there's another piece to that report that came out of the Ohio Department of Health regarding suicide rates, and they found a similar increase and a similar rate of suicide among older people over,
yes,
the age of 65. And it just seems like that's telling us something.
Right.
It's the same thing that we're saying for children.
Right. Right.
Such an opportunity for connection. Right.
Right.
Right. Loneliness has the same health effect as smoking. It's a very, very powerful indicator of health and risk factor for health. So being connected to others through some kind of an organization, through some kind of group, having meaning and purpose and relatedness is vital for people's well-being.
You know, Mim, you know, you've talked about this forever. Schools have a lot of demands on, it's not one individual who's saying no more recess or arts don't matter.
This is where the great teachers are the under.
Do it anyway.
Do it. The great teachers. And I just came from a national teachers conference last night and the National Association of 10,000 Teachers. And it gives you hope. Because nobody's in early childhood, for one, for the money or for the hours or for the perks.
I mean,
one high or for, you know, for the pink Cadillacs or anything. I mean, everyone, you know, I would say the majority of the people are just people who care about kids and dedicated to kids and love kids and want to do the best for kids. So that gives you hope. But exactly what you're saying, despite all, I mean, they have to be creative. Yeah, and you can't just – and the young teachers coming out now of school, they're not getting the joyfulness. They're not getting the – they're getting the curriculum. They're getting the standards. They're getting the testing. So, you know, everything we do is have to be advocates for the creative education and parents and families to the schools their children go to, advocates for the arts, for the music, for the joy, for the play, for the instruments. When they take instruments out of school, some kids only went to school for their instrument.
Mm-hmm.
And take the instrument away and like, why am I going to school? And I'm back in my doldrums. So we have to be advocates all the time for the good things that help the children.
Barbara in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Barbara.
Yes, my question is about active shooter drills. I'm very, very concerned what I hear from my educator friends about how the kids are traumatized by these. And so I'm wondering what your guests have to say about how can schools prepare children for these when they're coming up in a kind way, and how can families deal with and watch for trauma afterwards?
Mary Freistad.
We are living in a very challenging time, and I think to reassure kids that that parents have faith that their teachers will do the best to keep them safe if anything ever occurs at school, and to convey that you've had a drill, so if anything happened, you would know what to do, but we don't expect that this will ever enter your life. It's a very tough situation because we are in very troubled times in our country.
Go ahead, honey.
And I would say that for kids, a comment about guns is that we talk about means restriction. When kids are very depressed, we know that the very intense feelings of there's no other solution, I just need to die, doesn't stay at that high sustained level for a long period of time. So if you are a gun owner and if you have a child or adolescent who is depressed, who is unhappy, who is thinking, has had thoughts about suicide, and don't be afraid to ask. It doesn't put the thought into their head. But if you have a household with a member like that, it is essential to get the gun locked away and the ammunition locked away someplace else, because this isn't a pro-gun or an anti-gun statement. This mm-hmm. is a means reduction statement for kids who are at risk for dying from suicide. Same things with medications. Right. If you have any concerns about the safety and well-being of a family member, and again, don't be afraid to ask. It doesn't implant the thought to lock things away, to lock medications away, to lock dangerous chemicals away.
What does it do when you talk to a child about something like suicide?
It lets them know that they can have a conversation about it. And if you can do that in a way of, I just want you to know that I deeply love you and care about you, and if you are ever having these thoughts, please come and let me know, because I want to be here to support you and get you through that time and get you the help that you need.
Something I read to prepare for this said that, you know, parents being around the kids, is there's nothing more powerful than that, and they don't have to be necessarily talking to them all the time, just to be with them.
Absolutely right. You don't want to turn this into a nightly mm-hmm.
interrogation.
What is your mood rating today?
Yeah, right.
Right, because teenagers will immediately say, I don't want that.
Yeah.
Okay. So that is not so helpful. But to be available and to convey that if anything is troubling you, you are always welcome to come and talk with me. I am always
actually say it out loud. Don't assume they know that.
Don't assume that they know. Even if you think they should know, there's no harm in saying that.
Well,
and can I say a quick thing? Piggybacking on something Mary said that just triggered when it went back to the question. So when the kids are doing these drills, I think Mary's comment, we care about you, we're protecting you. This doesn't mean it's going to happen, but if it does, if things happen, like fire drills, we've been doing fire drills since everybody listening can
remember. And we're not afraid of fires happening.
How it's presented. Right. How it's presented. Mm-hmm. If the teacher is cool and not frightening the children, but if it says, hey, we need to know how to do this for our own sake, and we love you, and we want you to be safe.
Mimi Brodsky-Chenfeld, as always, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, sweetie.
And also Mary Freistad, professor of psychiatry at Ohio State University's Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Health. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks to everybody else for listening. We'll put those numbers in there, those help numbers, on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. And thanks so much for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.